Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, for this next hour, they're going to be the views of Doug Millar, who I've known, I guess, for 20 more years. And Doug has always been on the front lines of the battle to try to expose what's going on behind the scenes. He's been working for some years with Ted Gunderson and John DeCamp and others about the pedophile and other sects that are working within our society. Truly depraved people, many of them working at the highest levels of our government. Because, of course, as you know, I believe that there are powerful spiritual forces that energize these people, and anything that, of course, is in direct confrontation with the laws of God is what they embrace. Doug, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Dr. Stan.
Well, tell us a little bit about yourself for the people out there who don't know you.
Okay, I was born in Portland, Oregon, age 8. We moved to Alaska, so I was raised in Anchorage, Alaska, 35-year resident. I was attending weekly Democrat luncheons there when President Kennedy was assassinated. So I've been investigating the secret societies that manipulate our country and the world ever since. And so you and I think we started about the same time in that arena, wasn't it? About the early 60s when you started also?
I started in 1962. So
right.
you were already going in 62 or 63 anyway.
Okay. And so then after losing a son with cancer and a divorce up there in Anchorage, I decided to move to Santa Rosa, where a high school buddy of mine moved after he married a high school sweetheart. And the result was that I was here 10 years from 1982 to 92, and actually even was a Chamber of Commerce on a weekly basis with the Board of Directors because I was on the Legislative Committee, active in politics, I was elected Republican, and also active in my church, and I had no idea that children were being brought to our county and they were being used in snuff films. In other words, they torture and murder children on film. And when I learned that 10 years later and found the FBI refused to investigate it, I realized that maybe I didn't even know what the Achilles heel of the New World Order was until that date. And the next day I woke up and realized that it's time to leave the business world and start investigating these things full time. So
this having to do with the Bohemian Grove that's there in Santa Rosa?
Yes, I didn't know it at the time, but it does. We know that Bohemian Grove, which is in our county, Sonoma County, where Santa Rosa is the largest city between San Francisco and Portland, Oregon. And that's what is the capital of the county. And there's six area counties, and there's an attorney here at our home now, just came in, although he's not listening right now, he's in the other room, but he said, do you think it's just a coincidence that three of the six Bay Area counties have the same address, 600, for their so-called Hall of Justice, the county courthouse where the sheriff and the district attorney all have their offices? I said, well, I've never heard of this before. And so we found out that the largest Masonic lodge between San Francisco and Portland, Oregon, has the same address, 600, here in Santa Rosa. The Druids have the largest, they call it Grove, the state right here. They have 500 members.
Are you talking about the Druids, or are you talking about the Bohemian Grove?
Talking about the Druids.
All right. All right, we'll be back in just a moment here with Doug Millar. Ladies and gentlemen, there are a lot of things out there that most people have just never heard of. Well, Doug, you were talking about the Druids. Certainly the Druids are a religious sect, a very occult religious sect. It dates back many thousands of years. It was the Druids were at the Stonehenge over in England, and, of course, they still have the regular meeting there. Probably the most famous member was a man named Winston Churchill, who's always had good press, but not because of what he did, because he'd done some terrible, terrible things, but because the occult influence in our media is just overwhelming. But you go ahead and pick up the story there. Anyway, you lived in Santa Rosa, and here's the center of the Bohemian Grove. Here you're hearing about children being used for snuff films and this sort of things. Are these films circulated widely throughout the world?
Well, as you know, it happens worldwide, but because the leading occultists control our media, for example, they say there's about 3 million Masons in the nation, USA, but most of them are good people. They love the Constitution. They love our country. They have no idea that their leadership, which is about 5% of the Masons in America, are 33rd-degree Masons and involved in Lucifer worship. And this is coming from Masons who've written books exposing it. But the bottom line is that a lady told me, who was raised in Illuminati, I met her in Portland, Oregon, the second time, the first time I met her in Washington, D.C. with her husband, and she said, remember this, the Druids and the Illuminati are one and the same.
All
and
right.
I've never heard that before or never since, but from her lips, and she was in a good position to know.
Well, of course, the Illuminati, as they were organized back in 1776 by Adam Weishaupt, were simply a continuation of the ancient mystery religions, and there's a continuity of these secret societies and mystery religions, you know, going back into the, you know, thousands of years before Christ was born, but certainly, you know, since Christ was born, why we find within the Christian religion the Gnostics, which are basically a branch of the knowledge of the mystery religions. In fact, if you read Albert Pike on Masonry, his book Morals and Dogma, he will tell you that Masonry is simply a modern-day manifestation of the Gnostic beliefs. Of course, we're known to the Templars and known to the Rosicrucians and the upper echelons of Masonry. But, of course, the average individual has no idea. But five of our last 12 presidents were actually members of the Masonic Order. One of them, of course, was an honorary Mason. That was he received the 33rd degree in the Oval Office. But the others...
That was President Reagan,
yeah,
right?
President Reagan, right? And then, of course, but people have never heard that, but you can verify it on the Internet. I will be back in just a moment.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Doug Millar, who's been studying what's going on in our country for many years. Are you spending more or less full time at this at the present time, Doug?
Well, yes. When I found out what was going on here and being covered up locally, I just realized this has got to be the Achilles heel of the New World Order, and I decided to leave the business world and start investigating it full time 16 and a half years ago, and I've been doing it ever since. And
well, how do you make a living?
You can't make a living doing it. Ted Gunderson has devoted his last years, 29 to be exact, since he retired from the FBI in 79. He's divided all of his time doing the same thing, and I had the privilege of meeting him through reading his name in one time in the Franklin cover-up, Child Abuse, Satanism, and Murder in Nebraska. You mentioned John DeCamp that wrote that book. And so I've been have the privilege of working with both of those gentlemen for over 16 years in many states. And I was just on the phone several times with Gunderson tonight and doing some research for him on the Internet. And DeCamp returned my call tonight. And so I keep in touch with these gentlemen on a regular basis because, you know, we're each in our own cities and states, but we all investigate the same enemies of our country who have subverted our Constitution and attempting to subvert the world when America falls, as you know better than me, Dr. Stans, as you've been studying this more than I have, actually. You know that when America falls, the whole world falls like dominoes.
No question about that, and that's why, of course, we have to really recognize what's going on, because, of course, it's one thing to focus on the pedophilia and the secret societies, but unless we understand the spiritual force that actually energizes these groups, why, of course, it's almost impossible to be able to address them. And, of course, people have to understand there is a certain supernatural element out there, and there really are people who've given themselves over. To the dark side. They've made a deal with Satan, and they are actually very, very wealthy, and they're very, very famous, and they're very, very prominent. They're above the law. But if one day they're going to be answerable to our Lord, that is the one satisfying thing. In fact, I have the transcript of a 60-minute interview with one of the leading musicians in our country. I won't mention his name. Anybody could call me, and I'll give it to the name off the air. But he is probably one of the most famous singers we have, performers. He's been at it for 30 or 40 years. I mean, on tour, at least 30 years. I'll use his name. It's Bob Dylan. And actually, we saw him on 60 Minutes. I'm sure most people watched the interview without giving it a second thought, but what basically was said was the man who was interviewing Bob Dylan said, well, why are you still on tour? I mean, you've done everything. You've got all the money you could use. I mean, why are you still doing this at your age? And Bob Dylan said, because I made a deal or have an agreement. And the man said, well, who do you have an agreement with? And Bob Dylan looked down at the floor, and he said, "With the force that rules this world, and the other world."
Wow!
And of course, I actually set away and got the exact transcript. I wanted to be sure I had the words exactly right, and that's what he said, because I had a deal. I made a deal, and with the guy who runs this world and the other world, and of course, he's talking about the devil.
Of course.
But, of course, the average individual cannot understand that this is really going on. We have a wonderful DVD called They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll that goes into the whole of the music industry. And if everybody could see those DVDs, they'd begin to understand that this doesn't not just in the music industry. It's in our politics. It's in the people of great wealth in banking and finance and corporations. They get where they are because they made a deal. And they have to keep
sure.
It. Well, anyway,
I'm sure you've talked to people about this, but you know, it's fascinating to me that having met a couple of people that actually were involved in the Illuminati, and one was in his late 70s, I had a witness with me when we met with him, and we didn't know when we were meeting with him that he actually had run Bohemian Grove for 3 years, Governor Nelson Rockefeller in New York. He was working in the mansion with him. And this man's name is Dr. Keegan, K-E-E-G-A-N. And so when I found out he had been a manager for Bohemian Grove, and since I was meeting with him over in the Palm Springs desert, I asked him, I said, well, I've got an appointment in L.A., but how about this? Let me make a call here. I'd like to postpone my meeting. And so I spent hours talking to this man.
Was he willing to talk to you?
Oh, yes. He was a very bitter man because, as it turned out, I got distracted. A phone call coming in. He said that he was very bitter because of the fact that he had this mansion. He was living on the property, but in a double-wide mobile home because they'd foreclosed on his mansion at his age, and he thought he'd served the dark side so long and so well that he never thought they would ever go after him and his property. And so he just opened up and talked quite openly. He said, I'm obligated to answer all of your questions. And so I said, well, based on the questions you've already answered for me, you're a member of the Illuminati, aren't you? He said, yes, I am. And I said, that means you're... were raised in Illuminati, and he said, yeah, I've got two brothers who are also in their 70s now, and they're coming to me because I'm an Episcopal priest, and I was in charge from the Mississippi River East, the whole eastern seaboard there, and for a year, but it was no challenge, so I quit, but they're coming to me and asking me about Jesus Christ now, because we've done so many things They're not, what would you say, legal. And he said, but we don't operate like the Satanists do. We are Lucifer worshipers, and so we balance the scales. For every evil deed we do a good deed to keep the scales balanced. Now, is that sick or not?
Well, I tell you what, is he still alive?
I doubt it, but...
well, anyway, of course, I believe that there really are Luciferians, and what most people don't understand is this all goes back to the basic Gnostic tenets, that there are two gods. And lots of people say, I worship God, but they don't tell you what God they worship. And until you understand Gnosticism, you can't understand what these people are saying, because they talk the same words that you do, but they have an entirely different meaning. And they
exactly.
sort of laugh at us because we're so foolish we don't understand the truth about what this is about.
Yep, I agree.
Well, anyway, of course, how long ago did you have a chance to see him, Doug?
This was in 96.
All right, fine.
I met him in Las Vegas at a preparedness expo, and he seemed like a fish out of water. He didn't seem like any of the rest of us there, and so I took his name and phone number, and so my friend from Las Vegas was born and raised there. She and I went there. Met with him together.
Doug, are you on a regular hardline telephone? Because just sometimes it sounds like you might be on a speakerphone or cell phone.
Okay, I got on a speakerphone because for some reason...
I want to get the best tone we can. The speakerphone just doesn't give us the clarity that we need. Okay, are you there, Doug?
Yes, I'm listening here. But the problem is, because that incoming call... Can't switch it off the speakerphone now.
You can't get off the speakerphone?
No. Is that causing you a problem?
Well, it just isn't the quality of sound we like to have. You should always
be
on.
How about this? Why don't you call me back?
All right, fine. We'll call you right back here in just a moment and get that. So you hang on. My producer will be with you in just a moment here. All right,
okay.
Fine. We'll ask Cindy and Andy to go ahead to call Doug back so we can get hold of him. And just see if we can get a little better quality of the line. Our telephone number, of course, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, but we're not going to take any calls right now. I will ask Andy if he'll go ahead and call our guest back. But for the people out there, people say, these things don't exist. Yes, they do exist. And, of course, the thing is that people who talk about this very often are killed. People say, well, that couldn't be true. And yet, of course, if you talk to somebody like Gregory Reed, who's been our guest recently, has written a wonderful new book, which we carry, called The Trojan Shirts. But Gregory was actually raised in the occult. And, of course, when he came out of it, probably, maybe 15 or 20 years ago, he and about 250 other people were going all across America trying to awaken the American people about this satanic threat. And then the CIA organized something called the False Memory Syndrome, and, of course, very well financed. In fact, we even had people calling us all the time to try to convince us that this False Memory Syndrome was a reality, that all these people who thought that they'd been, satanically abused really weren't, of course. And then, of course, they went after everybody, or the 250 people who were involved in this organized effort to expose the satanic influence and the satanic covens in America. And they destroyed all but about five of them. But some people were very effective, and they were totally discredited. The Satanists are alive and well in America today, and the reason you're not hearing about them is because they don't want you to. They want you to believe. I think it was best said in a book, I think it was Dialogue of the Devil by C.S. Lewis, as the one devil said, once we can convince them we don't exist, at that time, we will have won. Well, Doug, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Okay, fine. That sounds much better. So anyway, go right ahead. Tell us a little bit about this. I guess we're going to have to go to a break, but when we get back, we're going to talk to Doug. He's been investigating the same things I have for a long time. Had the opportunity to talk to people who have been, of course, involved in this world satanic movement, and certainly we've talked to people who were, involved in Satanism and come out of it and trying to educate people. But you pay a terrible price when you do that because, of course, you will come under tremendous physical and spiritual attack. And, of course, some people are able to do it. Others are not. There are not very many. Of the original group, Doug Gregory Reed was in, and we do carry his book, Dialogue of a Devil Hunter, and certainly the Trojan Shirts. Why, he said there are only five of the original 250. All the rest have been neutralized. All right, Doug, go right ahead.
Okay, I had a chance to also meet a Rothschild in Anchorage, Alaska. I was out passing out some information early in the morning near the courthouse, and I ran across a law to Rothschild. So I went back after he opened, and I talked to him, and I said, you know, I understand that all of you are from the same bloodline because you were the Baugh, B-A-U-G-H, and changed the name to Red Shield, in German is Rothschild. And I said, can you tell me a little bit about your family? He said, no. I said, you know, I'm just one of the lowlifes here in the pecking order, and I really don't, I'm not involved with the family activities, the finances of the world and things like that. But then I read about a Rothschild who had just met with our governor in Alaska, and so I was headed for Seattle, and I thought it was interesting that Rothschild was in Juneau, Alaska, meeting with our governor, and I had an appointment with a stockbroker for lunch. I made it one day and went over the next day to meet him, and I found out he'd already left for lunch. And I was shocked that he stood me up, and I said, well, where is he? I'm supposed to have lunch with him. Well, he's at lunch with Lord Rothschild from France. And I said, where? And it was at the Olympic Club, which is a private club in downtown Seattle, and I literally ran 2.5 blocks with my heavy briefcase to get there. I waited till someone came out, slipped in the door, no eye contact, headed for the first hallway I saw, and found the restroom where Rothschild was speaking. Found a back seat there, sat down, before he had the lunch, and they were listening to him speak. And it was amazing because after that, his speech, then I sat with him one-on-one and talked to him for about 20 minutes with his chauffeur there and tried to sound like I was sympathetic and everything, and I tried to ride with him to his next event, but he said, no way. They weren't taking anybody in their limo. And but, you know, it was Felipe Rothschild. And as we know, they founded the Illuminati, and, of course, they're Ashkenazi Jews. They're not the bloodline of the Israelites. They call them the 13th tribe, as I understand it. But anyway, my wife was an Ashkenazi Jew. Her father was G.M. Meyerhoff, M-E-Y-E-R-H-O-F-F. And so she had, you know, the nose of the Rothschild and the Ashkenazis. But, you know, we both became Christians. I got some Jewish blood in me, too. And we both became Christians after we had some marriage problems and decided that maybe we want to try and keep our family together, we better accept the Lord as our Savior. So we did that, but it was still a very rocky marriage because when she wrote the book Sybil, she told me about it, and you may recall that it was a girl who had about 15 alter personalities, and she said this is a true story, and she was telling me over dinner, and she said, you know, when she got done with the book, she said, you know, I think I have the same problem Sybil has. So it was a very rocky 15-year marriage. But, you know, it helped me prepare for what I'm doing now. And I kept her posted what I was doing. She passed away about 4 or 5 years ago.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment with Doug Millar. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, our guest is Doug Millar. Well, Doug, let's just stay on the subject of really, of course, the things that are going on up there in the Santa Rosa area. Now,
okay,
Cindy,
good.
As far as the Bohemian Grove, have you investigated that and its relationship to what's going on? And then is there a separate grove for the Druids up there as well?
Well, no, but when they have their cremation of care, about 100 people dressed in bright colored robes, and they cremate a coffin, and they look like druids.
All right, fine. For our listeners out there, at the Bohemian Grove every year, here's where the leaders of our country go, the presidents, the secretaries of state, the people who control the media, the people who control the wealth of our country, and there several thousand of them are invited there on a regular basis. And every year they have this ceremony, and it's in front of this 40-foot stone owl. I think it's probably a cement owl, which is, of course, is a emblem of Moloch, the Druid deity. And of course, they're there, and they're wearing their robes and their hoods, and they have their candles and their chants, and they have a feigned human sacrifice every year. This is part of the ritual of the Bohemian Grove. So pick up the story there, Doug.
Yes, and so that's used to be on the first night, on a Friday night. Now they do it on a Saturday night, and they have the peak, which is they're there for 17 days, including 3 weekends, and they bring in their guests, and combined on the second weekend, which is when they have the peak in number of attendees there, they have close to 3,000 now. When I moved here in 82, it was about 2,000, so they're growing. And, of course, what they do is there's a book out called Transformation of America by Kathy O'Brien and Mark Phillips. And in there she says that they told her exactly where they wanted her as a CIA sex slave to lie so they could get the her sex partners on film. So that way, of course, the intent was to blackmail them later. And so, they say whatever you want to have, whether it's a little boy, a little girl, a male or female, prostitute, whatever it is, or sex slave, they provide that for you, and then they film you and blackmail you. Very sick organization.
It really is. And, Chris, as incredible as it seems, I've talked to Kathy O'Brien, who wrote the book Transformation of America. We've actually carried the film put up by Alex Jones, who snuck in there, and you'll actually see the Druid-like ceremonies. It's called... I think it's called the Bohemian Grove, the Secrets of the Bohemian Grove, and then we actually have a four-tape set of my interviews with people who've studied the Bohemian Grove or been inside the Bohemian Grove, and of course it's a very, very dangerous thing to do. Back one young man I met at the conspiracy conference had been in the Bohemian Grove in the off years when they weren't having the ceremony, off time, and he actually took pictures, gave them to Alex Jones, and they ended up trumping up all sorts of charges against him, and he's languishing in prison someplace. And his crime? Why, he had just told us what he had actually seen there at the Bohemian Grove.
Yeah, he was Ted Gunderson's second webmaster. The first one Ted had, they murdered him. The second one, they framed and put in prison, and he's in there for decades. And yet the children said he never touched us inappropriately. So if a man doesn't touch children inappropriately, it's more of a thought crime now. And the enticement process, and so I knew Chris... Jones, I spent a lot of time with him. He showed me the footage he took pictures of and gave to Alex Jones for the second documentary on Bohemian Grove. And I really admired, and still do, of course, obviously, Alex Jones, because he had the courage of his convictions after we put out the story exposing the human sacrifice at Bohemian Grove in the Santa Rosa Sun here. I persuaded a Marxist buddy of mine to write the story when he told me the analogy with the Moloch in the Old Testament. We actually believe, Stan, that is a 39-foot tall because of the fact that it's in the 39th parallel, and because, of course, 13 times 3 is 39, and Illuminati, according to Doc Marquis, does everything in threes and multiples of 3.
All right, fine. Well, I've never really had an opportunity to measure it. Maybe it's 39 feet, not 40 feet.
Well,
but we do have some of the publications of the Bohemian Grove, and in one of them, in the dedication page, the word and the phrase they use, and I think it's correct, we revere the owl. we revere the owl. Now, why? That's all it says in the pages. We revere the owl. Well, the owl, of course, was a demonic caricature. It's something that ancient societies and secret societies have always honored as the owl. It's wise, and of course, it's truly occult and demonic. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Doug Millar, and we're talking about the Bohemian Grove and certainly the fact that the leaders of our country go there on a yearly basis. In fact, some people go there because this is where you get a chance to meet the movers and shakers. In fact, Richard Nixon was there, but apparently he had actually told some of his friends that he didn't like, the only reason he went there was because, of course, he liked to associate with rich and powerful people. But, I mean, he was repulsed by the running around naked and other vile activities that so many of the leaders of our country actually engage in.
His actual statement, on the Watergate tape was that Bohemian crowd are the faggiest group of people I've ever met in my life.
By faggiest, of course, he meant most homosexual or perverted, I'm sure.
Exactly, sure. And it was actually in the local paper here in the county is called the Press Democrat, and it was purchased by the New York Times back in the late 80s or mid 80s. I remember reading at the time that the people that owned the Press Democrat at the time, since they were managing it after it was sold, they put an article in the paper that said that we were surprised that the Press Democrat was sold for much more than it was worth. But, of course, they also owned a TV station, and so the New York Times obviously wanted to control the media because I'm sure, Bohemian Grove is a very influential place. And then we have the frantic cover-up that came out, Child Abuse, Satanism, Murder in Nebraska. And I'm sure you've had Ted Gunderson and John DeCamp on your program, haven't you?
Well, I haven't had John DeCamp, but I've certainly had Ted Gunderson a number of times.
I'd encourage you to have DeCamp on sometime, too, because in his book on pages 102 to 105, the first edition, he mentions the fact that his key witness in his book, the Paul Benanti, was flown from Nebraska to Sacramento, and then they were taken to a place that had tall trees. Well, what's a tall tree to a kid from who's only seen oak trees in Nebraska? I had no idea, but come to find out, when I met with DeCamp Labor Day weekend in 92 and told him about this occult ritual they have when they cremate the coffin and everything, we were having dinner, we were getting acquainted, because he was going to be speaking in a week later here in Santa Rosa on 9/11 of all things, 92. And he said, that's it. I said, what? He said, that's all we're looking for.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Doug Millar. And, of course, we're talking about certainly John DeCamp. John DeCamp is a fascinating fellow. He used to be in the legislature. Was that in Kansas where he served?
Nebraska.
Kansas, Nebraska. Anyway, in Nebraska. And of course, then he wrote a book on the Franklin cover-up, which was basically a cover-up of a pedophilia ring that went from Boys Town and from various high people there in Nebraska all the way up into the White House itself. Well, needless to say, of course, that this got him a lot of death threats. He was forced out of the legislature. He lives in a small town in Nebraska with very, very few people in it, ready to protect his children because, of course, somebody had come up into the yard with a car, run over their pet dog and told his two children who are playing in the yard, that's going to happen to you if your dad keeps on talking.
Yep, and it's really sad.
It really is, but this is the sort of thing that happens in the United States. And why doesn't anybody do anything about it? Why don't you hear about it? Why? Because you're not supposed to. Because we have freedom of the press in America. And that means if you own the press, you have the freedom to suppress whatever you want to. And the truth about these occult organizations is carefully suppressed all across America today. So pick up the story there, Doug.
Okay, so yeah, I 1999, in September, I visited John DeCamp in Lincoln, Nebraska, the state capitol, where he'd been a senator for state in 16 years. Even his enemies said in the local statewide paper called the World Herald that he was the most influential legislator in the Senate, and also said he was the most influential man in the state's history. And he had the courage to go ahead and write the book. He said it was actually Bill Colby, former head of the CIA, that was his mentor for 25 years, and told him, "John, you know too much. You've got a lovely wife here and your four children. If you don't write a book about what you know, that's the only way you're going to stay alive, because you know too much. And that way it will be a life insurance for you." And that's why DeCamp wrote the book. And so I had the privilege of staying at his place one night we were going through there in 99, and I was amazed to see that he has an indoor Olympic-sized pool for his children, so that, you know, the people can't even kidnap his children when they're swimming. It's pretty sad. I'm sure that they think it's a privilege, and it is. I mean, obviously, there aren't not many pools, I'm sure, that size in Nebraska.
But and not in that little town where he's living, I'm sure.
Yeah, there's less than 300 people there. And, of course, Ted Gunderson then rents from him about a block and a half away in a house that DeCamp remodeled. And because, you know, Ted had so many death threats and attempts on his life in Las Vegas and other places as he was investigating, he decided to go back there and be in a safer environment.
Well, it's for the average individual, this sounds like something you might see on television, but this is the real world that some people live in. I've met John DeCamp, of course, Ted Gunderson we've had on many times, and certainly I've known Doug Millar for many years. These things really do go on in the United States. And those of you who have listened to us regularly, we've talked about the CIA assassins we've interviewed, people like L.D., Brown, and it was hired by the CIA to kill a drug dealer in Mexico. The only trouble was the drug dealer. Actually, it was Terry Reid who had written a book about George Bush and Bill Clinton called Compromised. And then, of course, Colonel Marvin, Daniel Marvin, we've had on many, many times. Chuck Tatum, his body, we're told, had washed up on a beach in the Caribbean recently. This is the reality. We've interviewed people who've been obviously killed. One of them was shot in the head twice. And it was declared a suicide. He shot himself twice because he wanted to make sure he was dead. That was Gary Webb. Do
exactly.
These things really happen?
I had a privilege of meeting Gary Webb one time. And I called him and asked out his number when I met with him and Mike Grouper down in Santa Monica right after he'd released his book. And so I called him and asked him, I said, you know, since you put out that book, I'm sure you've got all kinds of ammo for a second book. He said, oh, I sure have, but I'm not writing on the same topic. I said, oh, really? You're writing a new book and it's not volume two of the same topic? He said, no. I asked him, what is he writing about? He said, I'm sorry, but I can't tell you. And, of course, they shot him twice and called it a suicide before he got his book out.
Right. Well, unfortunately, this is the real world out there. But I think that we're going to see more and more evidence of this as our society begins to break down and these evil people will do anything they can to silence those who are trying to bring out the truth. And, of course, we can talk about the Bohemian Grove, but unless you understand the spirits of forces that energize this movement.
That's right.
We can talk about the Bilderbergers, but unless you understand the spiritual forces, the dark, spiritual, satanic forces that energize many of these men, none of it makes sense. But how do we know they're there? Well, because they claim. They will tell you it's there. And if you haven't yet read the little pamphlet we're circulating, put out by the Lucis Trust, used to be the Lucifer Publishing House. It's called The Working of the Spiritual Hierarchy. If you get any of our material and ask for it, why, we'll be glad to provide it for you. You need to know what they say, not what I say, because I'm just a guy behind a microphone. But we'll give you their publications and tell you where you can get their other publications. And believe me, they are openly talking about the current economic downturn as the vehicle by which they are going to bring about their New World Order and their New World Religion and install their New World Leader.
So, of course, now, Dr. Sam, I'm curious, what was the copyright year of that publication by Lucis Trust?
Well, basically, it was back in the late 40s or early 50s, but they actually put it out and encouraged people to disseminate it, so we're just disseminating it.
Right.
We're helping them.
Good for you. I'm glad you're doing that, because I know that Madame Blavatsky,
she was a woman who formed the Theosophical Society back in the 1870s.
Right, and she was the lover of General Albert Pike.
Right. Well, I don't know whether she was a lover of him, but perhaps she was. I really don't know. But
Phil Jasper put out a book called Global Tyranny Step by Step, and he said that every time Pike was in Washington, D.C., she was always on his arm.
Well, I know. You're absolutely right. I didn't know that it was just more than... who can say? That's a long time ago, because...
We weren't there, right?
Pike wrote his book in 1872. He was a Luciferian, and so is a Madame Blavatsky. I guess maybe when two Luciferians get together, why they do what Luciferians do, who knows?
Yeah, I remember she formed the Lucifer Publishing and the Lucifer Trust, and then they changed it to Lucis. Was that Latin for Lucifer?
I don't know, but it has headquarters in Washington, D.C.,
right,
in Geneva, and in London. And it's very well funded by some of the wealthiest foundations in the world. And you can find that they fund their front groups like World Goodwill and the new group of World Servers. And anybody who wants to get into that more, why, we'd be glad to provide you the information, but not on the air. So we certainly don't want to end up getting sued. But we do have the documents off of their website where they tell you, oh, that the next president is, his foundation is actually funding this front for the Lucis Trust. One of the two men who are described as the wealthiest men of the world, their foundation is funding the Lucis Trust. So understand that this is not casual. In fact, I will not go into this in any more detail, but I understand in John DeKemp's book, he also discusses a man who is very, very wealthy, one of the wealthiest men in the world, and who would actually...
Warren Buffett.
I really don't want to mention any names there. I don't want to end up getting sued, but...
I don't mind doing it unless you don't want me to.
I really don't want to get into that. But anyway, of course, John DeKemp does discuss this man who was one of the wealthiest men in the world today, and his involvement in some of these aberrant activities. But maybe that's why he's so wealthy.
Why, sure. I'm sure it is.
And I think it's so important that people understand it's not imaginary. These things do go on. And this is covered in John DeKemp's book. It's entitled The Franklin Cover-Up. And he says things in that book which he will not say on the air. So all we can do is just suggest we really should carry the book. I think we'll try to get it from John if we can. And
do that, because to understand that he put out a new edition in 2005, and you can't order it from any bookstore in America because the ISBN number, when you plug it in, it says out of print. It's a lie. They program the computers to block that, and so that should encourage people to want to order it from John DeKemp, or hopefully you'll have him on and then they can order it from you, because that's an extremely important book.
Well, that's what they did with both of my books. They did that with AIDS, The Unnecessary Epidemic. And then, of course, if you go to the bookstore and try to order my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, well, they'll tell you it was out of print.
No kidding. Interesting.
But this is pretty standard operating procedure.
That's your bestseller, I understand, is both book and DVD, isn't it? And video?
Right. And we just keep trying to get it out. And in fact, it is going to be coming out in hardback, or at least by a professional publisher, hopefully the first of next year. And we'll get a much, much larger coverage. So we're looking forward to that.
Good.
Doug, now, what are some of the other organizations or activities you'd like to talk about?
Well, I'd like to talk about the Lieutenant Colonel Michael Aquino.
We want to be a little careful what he says, what you say about him, because actually he ends up suing people. He's a general now, I understand, is he?
Well, no, he's a retired full colonel. They claimed they got rid of him. He went into the Army Reserves, and then because he got embarrassed the military in the late 1980s when he was sex abusing children in his home, and we have a three-page copy of the San Francisco police report we're going to be turning over to the San Francisco Police Commissioners meeting on Wednesday. So we passed out 600 flyers at the Thanksgiving to Native Americans who went to Alcatraz. There were 3,400 of us there, and so we invited them to come on down next Wednesday, which is, of course, just 2 days from now, and be there when we have this, give this report to the police commissioners and ask them to reopen the case against Aquino, because I've tried to provoke him into suing me, and he's not that stupid, because he knows I can go in for discovery, and DeCamp told me the only way you can get these people to into court is to overreact, sue you, and then we go in for discovery. But
people have to understand that this was a colonel, a full army colonel. He was he was associated, I believe, at one time with Anton LaVey, the Satanist. But he created his own separate satanic group called the Temple of Seth. And, of course, he was involved in some very questionable practices there at the Presidio with as far as children were concerned. But it was all covered up. I mean, after all, so we can't let people know that military officers at the highest level, our military office would be allowed to carry on this way. Unfortunately, there is within the military, there is within the upper echelons of government, there is within certainly the great tax-exempt foundations, there is within, even within our church today, these satanic influences. Ted Haggard, for instance, headed the 300,000-member National Association of Evangelicals and used that position to undermine Christianity.
Sure,
Ted Haggard turned out to be a homosexual, cocaine-using homosexual, a minister of one of the largest Christian evangelical churches, mega churches in Colorado.
And I've been to his church in Colorado Springs before, of course, he was exposed. I was there back in 1999, year 2000.
And, of course, very often he'd be interviewed on nationwide television and always came through as such a dedicated Christian. Ladies and gentlemen, these people are working within the Protestant church, and they're working within the Catholic church. And because the best way to destroy Christianity is from within, not from a direct attack without. And this doesn't reflect on the average evangelical Christian. This doesn't reflect on the average Catholic, but it does show you how clever the demonic forces are as they infiltrate the Christian church.
That's for sure. Just like, remember I mentioned about Darge Keegan, that he was the Episcopal priest over all Episcopal churches, and here he was Illuminati.
And this was the man who was in the Illuminati, who was supposedly an Episcopalian church?
Yes, he was a head Episcopalian over all Episcopalian churches east of the Mississippi River.
Well, did you actually record any of your conversations with him?
You know, I was so frustrated when I got there. I didn't even have a tape recorder because I was just going to drop off my friend because she was so late. We were supposed to be there 2 hours earlier and meet with him, and I was going to just drop her off because I had an appointment in L.A. But when he told me that he said, oh, it's too bad you have to leave because I used to manage Bohemian Grove, I asked him if I could use his telephone because I wanted to postpone my meeting where we had a Dennis Whipple lined up to film my interview with a lady whose daughter-in-law was a Satanist. And so anyway, I called Dennis and I called Sandy Long. I postponed it. But I had no tape recorder. I was just so sick. I'm sure that if I had a tape recorder, he would never have opened up like this. But it was amazing when he told me that I'm obligated to answer all your questions honestly. But then when I started asking him about who are the original stockholders of the Federal Reserve, he said, I'm sorry, but I can't discuss that. And I said, wait a minute. You just told me 5 minutes ago that you're going to answer all my questions honestly. He said, yes, there's certain things I can't even divulge.
Oh, no, I think that's very interesting, Doug, because, of course, you know, we're told, you know, who the supposed stockholders are, but the truth of the matter is this is a privately owned central bank with lots of secrets. And we do know from reading what the Luciferians tell us that they have their people planted in finance, throughout the world. This is the incredible part. And, of course, money is one of the major tools the Luciferians use to enslave the people and, of course, to appeal to their lusts.
Yep. No question about it. And what is also fascinating, I said, well, that's fascinating. So you were there in 57 to 60. And I said, of course, I didn't move there until 82. But he said, yeah, it was fascinating because one of my relatives there gave me a tour and took me over to the Army National Guard Armory. I said, oh, yeah, I know where that is. I'm right on Highway 101. And he said, yeah, and he showed me the voting machines. They had storage there. He said, this is how we control the elections in Sonoma County. I said, no kidding. I said, so you're talking about, I know who your relative is. It's your cousin. And this doctor, Jim Keegan Sr., isn't it? He said, I'm sorry, but I can't answer that one either. I said, you already have. You told me it was one of your relatives. And you said your dad was in the finance business of financing homes and taught Joe Kennedy the mortgage business after they got out of the bootlegging days with the mafia in Chicago and New York. And so I understand. I said, I met Jim Keegan Sr. when he sold his mortgage business to Wells Fargo. And I went over there and he gave me a tour of his office. And I like him. But that tells me that he's Illuminati too. The whole Keegan family are Illuminati because you're in the mortgage business.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here in just a moment. Well, Doug, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Okay. Well, I would just encourage people, number one, to get the book, The Franklin Cover-Up, Child Abuse, Satanism, and Murder in Nebraska. I tell everyone it's the most important book written in your lifetime. If you want to understand what they have planned for you, and if you want to protect your children, grandchildren, your loved ones, but also yourself. And I'll put it up and get the other 10 books because it is so well documented and was inspired by Bill Colby, former head of the CIA, who made the decision. And DeCamp told me this in person when I was back there with him in 99, that Colby helped create the CIA, and he helped create such a Frankenstein, he decided he had to bring it down, and he paid for it with his life.
He was the fellow who went off in the canoe in the middle of a storm and died, is that him?
Yes, but there was no storm. It was all a put-up deal, and DeCamp doesn't talk about this, but Gunnarsson does. He put a bullet hole in his head and says, too bad he capsized in his boat and drowned.
Well, I have no question at all that Colby was done in it. Apparently, he was one of the few honest people there in the Central Intelligence Agency at the upper echelons.
A U.S. Marine, Lieutenant Colonel Don Gregg, G-R-E-G-G, was the one that bragged to his wife when he was in a drunken stupor one night that he took in a Navy SEAL team and kidnapped Colby.
Well, I think we can't prove it, so we don't want to put it out on the radio. We have to be careful of getting sued for things that we cannot document.
Well, I can introduce you to the man, a retired full colonel in the CIA, who was the one that told me that story because he knows his wife.
All right, fine. Well, of course, if you can get him to come on our radio program, we'd love to have him.
I'll see what I can do about that.
All right,
I
fine.
I won't disclose his name now.
Well, of course, as far as Don DeCamp, is he still busy working, researching, and trying to get the word out?
Oh, definitely. LAC did an update in 2005. I just talked to him tonight. He was hoping that I would get a chance to depose Aquino, but I had 3 attorneys licensed in California, and none of them were willing to tell me what to do to get him deposed, so I served him in the court when he was going after me with a restraining order for 3 years, but they didn't tell me I had to depose him before I was supposed to ask the commissioner to postpone the decision on the restraining order until I had a chance to depose Aquino.
We're just about out of time, Doug. Do you have a website you'd like to get out?
I don't. I just an investigator with no time for that. I'd love to have one. If somebody wants to help me put one together, I'd appreciate the help. Can I give my phone number?
Oh, sure. Go ahead.
Okay. It's 707-396-8215.
Go back.
Sandy Mary back in 1995.
Oh, Doug, hold there. Okay. You go ahead and get your telephone number off. One more time, then I'm going to have to let you go because the hour is just up.
Sure.
What's your telephone number again?
707 1-800-396-8215.
All right, this is a Doug Pillar, who I've known for a number of years. He's on the front lines of this battle. He's an investigator, works with Ted Gundersen, John DeCamp, former Senator John DeCamp of Nebraska. All three are dedicated to trying to get the truth out. But, of course, you can have all the information. You can't get it out. Why, it doesn't do any good, which is why I do what I do 5 hours a day. Doug, God bless you. Thanks so much. Keep in touch.
God bless you, Stan. Thank you. Bye.
Okay, fine. And, Chris, this is why we do what we do. And we do hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. Help us continue doing what we're doing. And, of course, telephone number if you'd like to become a member of the Radio Liberty family. 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And we certainly look forward to hearing from you. Then, of course, if you'd like to, of course, get some of our material, my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, our talk on the Forbidden Secret. That's the Forbidden Secret. And there's a syllabus that goes with that. Our talk on the secret knowledge, the overlaps the material in the Forbidden Secret. And you must understand, ladies and gentlemen, that Oprah Winfrey on CBS is one of the richest women in the world because she is part and parcel of this whole world occult movement. She has actually featured on her program a number of the leading occultists, including Rhonda Burns, who wrote a book called The Secret. It has sold some 6 or 7 million copies last time I checked, and millions of copies of her DVD. And she will tell you exactly what I tell you, that there is a secret and a force that's out there that you can tap into. But she tells you you should tap into it, and I want to warn you against it because it's what energizes everything that is evil in the world today. So the talk, The Forbidden Secret, we recommend it as well as the syllabus that will help you better understand the inaugural addresses, in presidential inaugural addresses in 2001 and again in 2005. You really need to see what was said, analyze what was said, and understand the secret and hidden message there about the angel who rides in the whirlwind and directs this storm. The angel who rides in the whirlwind and directs that storm. And you can pick that up on the Internet. You go to January 21st, 2001, inaugural address, 20th, 21st, something like that. Get the information. It's up on the website. Read it and understand what's going on. We want to announce, of course, that our CDs of the program we did of the annual conference are available. Talks by Dr. Russell Blaylock, talks by Patrick Wood on the Trilateral Commission. Dr. Blaylock talks about the danger of vaccines. Joanna Michelson talks about her experience in the occult as a medium. My talk on the oil depletion or the oil deception. Michael Shaw on sustainable development. All of the tapes are available in a CD form, five of them in a set, or you can get them individually. If you call us at 1-800-544-8927, my syllabus on the oil deception goes along with the talk, and you get the two of them at a reduced price. We think the information is vitally important just to show one of the other major deceptions that's being waged on the American people today. And then, of course, we have the four-tape set on Liberty, USS Liberty, the ship that was actually attacked by the Israeli planes, unmarked Israeli planes and Israeli torpedo boats back in 1967, and the duplicity of the people at the highest levels of our government to conceal their effort to kill those soldiers on board. Of course, one of them, the sailors on board, one of them was Robert McNamara, who, at least according to West Magazine, is a frequent guest at a place called La Boca Grande, an occult center in Colorado. So basically, you need to understand the background of the Liberty, and they left those people there to be killed the same way they left the people at the Murrah Building in Oklahoma to be killed. And, of course, the same way that they, well, we'll not get into that tonight. We'll be back in just a moment. Our number, 1-800-544-8927. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And, of course, I want to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Marion Bauman Parkhurst. And this is a fascinating story about a woman who was in Belsen prison and during the Second World War. And Ms. Parkhurst, thank you so very much for being with it.
Yes, I am glad I can help you.
All right, fine. And, of course, Mrs. Parkhurst, what are you? You're in your 90s now, aren't you?
Pardon?
Are you in your 90s?
I am 96 years old.
96 years old. Well, I'm glad we got a chance to talk to her book, Searching Survivor, and the Answers I Found.
Right.
And so, basically, of course, you were in Germany as Adolf Hitler came to power. In fact, you were, what, about 20 years old or so when he came to power?
I was about that, I would say, yes.
Now, fine, and so you were Jewish, your mother and father were Jewish?
Yes, I'm Jewish.
And basically, would you like to tell us what happened to the Jewish people at that time in Germany as the Nazis came to power?
Well, Hitler came to power in 1933, and it went slow first. He didn't know what really happened, but we knew it wasn't good. But all of a sudden, things started to move. The Jewish people couldn't do that, and the Jewish people couldn't do that. And some of them, they took away the business. And then later on, we had to wear yellow stars with the name Jew on it. You couldn't sit on benches in the park and things like this. And people who were very wise, like Albert Einstein, left Germany.
And because you stayed for a time, and then, of course, you went to Holland to live with your sister.
I went to Holland because my sister was married, sir.
Right. And so at least you were able to get out of Germany for a time. But then of course, the Nazis invaded Holland about 1940, 1941, and suddenly, why, you were under their control there as well. You mentioned that you were trained to be a pharmacist, but suddenly the pharmacist who were employing you was really forced to fire you because of the pressure, because you were Jewish?
You mean in Germany?
Wherever it was where you were training to be a pharmacist.
In Germany, yeah. He knew I was Jewish. He was not a Nazi.
But
some people were not Nazis, but the majority were.
In fact, I think it was very interesting. You mentioned that your brother had been told by his teacher that if the parents didn't go along with the Nazis, they were to be reported. In other words, your brother was supposed to report your parents to his teacher because your father opposed the Nazis.
Yes, that happened. And then a few days later, my brother was sent to Italy.
Right, but I think it's so, really, people have to understand that everything was based upon informants there. And just as it is here in America, of course, people are told, you know, if you're informed, you think somebody's a terrorist, let the government know, you know. Then, of course, it's a really very dangerous thing. Because
Hitler went to the children, and of course, children are very easy to influence.
And, of course, I think your father was very wise. They're very wise.
The children were for Hitler, you know. They loved him.
Right. Well, we'll be back in just a moment with Marion Bauman Parkhurst. Well, Sidney and Marion, of course, you were there. You were living in Holland, and of course, then when the Nazis came in, you really they eventually came and they took your mother and dad away. What year was that? Do you recall?
When they came to Holland in 1940.
Right. And when did the Nazis take your mother and father away?
My parents were still in Germany, and they had moved to Berlin, because Berlin wasn't as bad as Königsberg. But they couldn't stay there, it was impossible. So they came to Holland in 1942, I think.
All right, fine. And of course, then...
$10 in their pockets. They couldn't take any money with them. And my father, you know, tried to commit suicide.
And because he had been an officer, and during the First World War, he was a very brave and courageous and capable man. But of course, his feeling of despair, I'm sure, consumed him, as it did many of the Jewish people, as they realized that this wonderful world, this country that they loved and supported, had suddenly turned against them. And so many of the good people in Germany went right along with the Nazis, because if you didn't, why, you'd be in trouble yourself. Was that true?
Yeah, that's true.
All right, and then eventually, of course, they took your father away and to concentration camps.
Okay, my father, they came to Holland, and then in 1943, they started to take the people, no, 42 it was, started to take people away. First of all, they started to take young men. They told them they go to the labor camp. And they took young men, and later we found out they were all killed. And then they took old people, like my parents, and they went to Westerbork. That was a holding camp in Holland. And there my parents stayed for about 2 weeks, and then they were transported to wherever, I don't know. But my sister later on received a letter that my father was shot. He was shot because he was very busy in the Democratic Party.
All right, so your father was executed. You don't know what happened to your mother.
My mother probably went to Auschwitz and put in the gas oven.
All right, fine. Because it's only a matter of time, you knew, before you, Christian, your husband, would be arrested. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening, Marion Parkhurst, and she's 96, and we're talking about her book, Searching Survivor. And, of course, she ended up being sent to Bergen-Belsen prison camp. And initially, they were in a very, not such a bad camp. But you have to understand that there were about 140,000 Jews living in Holland. 107,000 of them were sent off to concentration camps, and only 5,000 came back. That's, 95% death rate. And, of course, the same thing, of course, Bergen-Belsen was even worse. How many people were in the camp there with you, Marion? Do you have any idea?
I couldn't tell you, because within Bergen-Belsen there were several camps.
I see, only about 200 people survived in Bergen-Belsen?
I don't know, because we were put on a train, but not all of them. Some stayed back, and I don't know how many stayed back. But we on the train, they were supposed to bring us to Auschwitz to be gassed. They didn't want us to be alive. The Americans were very close already.
And so this was the end of the war, and they were just taking them off to be gassed. How did you and your husband escape?
Oh, what?
How did you and your husband survive?
How did we survive?
Yes.
By the grace of God, I guess.
Well, that's a good answer as any, because, of course, you wonder why a few people survived, and so many, of course, were killed at that time.
I know. But we were supposed to walk to the station about 2 miles, and my husband was too weak. He was very sick, and I practically carried him, and I was stronger. It was my upbringing, because I trained for the Olympics, you know.
Marion actually trained for the Olympics in the 1936 Olympics.
Yeah, but they didn't take me because I was Jewish.
Right.
Yeah. So anyway, we got to the train, and I put my husband down, and they gave us a piece of bread, 2 centimeters. So I don't know how far that would bring us, that bread. And I saw a train with red beets. And I thought, I have to have some red beets. And the train was guarded with SS men, very, very closely guarded. And I took my chance because they might have shot me. So I ran over the trail to the where the beets were. I had to climb up. I took my scarf off of my head and put some beets in. And then I turned back, and then I looked at the guards. This was a strange thing. They all looked away. They didn't want to see me. They all looked away. And so I got away. But a couple of other people tried to do it, and then they shot some.
So you survived, and God was looking after you.
I survived. So I think the Lord has been with me all the time, even if I didn't know that.
It must have been very difficult. Of course, you were there during the bombing. So you were there during the bombing of Holland. And what about the German facilities when you were taken to the German town, to Bergen-Belsen? Was it pretty difficult? And were there a lot of air attacks at all? Did the Allies attack your camp or ever attack the rail line so the Germans couldn't move the people around?
I didn't answer the question.
Basically, did the Allies ever try attacking your camp in an effort just to disrupt things?
No, the Allies didn't attack the camp. However, the Allies bombed the train we were in. They didn't know that we were in there. And quite a few people were killed, and we ran out. And after that stopped, we saw that our guards had disappeared.
All right, fine. Well, when the end of the war came, of course, you
had... And when I took my husband and we went, I was going to look for food, the potatoes or something. And then I saw a jeep. But I wasn't sure if it was German or English. Then I heard some English words, and I ran over there and I said, wait, here's a train with dead and very sick people, you have to come. And within an hour they were there, they cleared everything out, they brought food, they were really fantastic, the Americans. Then they brought us in the village to the people, and they had to give up the bedroom, and they gave us a bedroom.
And so you and your husband survived, and did you gradually regain your strength? How did you live in Germany after the end of the war?
Yeah.
How were you able to get by? I mean, did a lot of people help you? Did you return to Holland, or what?
Yeah, they put us in a holding camp. We were full of lice and everything. She had to clean us first, you know. We have interpreters. We had all different kinds of lice, body lice and other lice. And they had to clean us. And then they fed us. And we stayed in the camp for about 2 weeks. And they put us in private homes.
Allow me to add a word.
No, we go right ahead.
Yeah, Marianne did not return to Germany at that time.
Right.
She never went back to live in Germany.
Right.
And she's been against any visitation to there to this day.
All right. Did she go back to Holland then for a time?
Yes, she went back to Holland. And there she had another baby, a second baby. The first one died in the concentration camp.
That's correct, yeah.
And then this one is alive to this day, and is a marvelous help to both of us. She lives nearby. And he's continually bringing his food and that sort of thing.
Oh, now, is he the woman who wrote the foreword to Marion's book?
Karen is her name.
All right, fine. So basically, the question is, why did this happen? And of course, it would be very easy to be terribly bitter about what had happened. Certainly, Karen talked about her dad, Marion's first husband, that... And he was always very withdrawn because, of course, what had happened. It must have been a terrible experience, you know, living in constant fear in the concentration camp, wondering when you would be taken off to be killed, or he and Marion would be taken off to be killed. So what was the end result? I mean, how did you manage to survive emotionally after this?
Very hard, because... I felt very guilty. Number one, I felt guilty because so many people were killed and I was alive. And I asked myself, why me? Why am I alive? And it was very hard to adjust. And at that time, when we came to Holland, there were no clergymen, no rabbis, no psychologists like they have today. That person says if you had nobody to help us emotionally, you know.
Well, of course, in your book you talk about finding God.
Yes, right.
Would you like to tell our listeners a little bit about that? Because that's really what sustained you through the difficult time, wasn't it?
Yes, right. Well, I asked once my father, Daddy, is there really a God? And my father gave me the answer. He said, yes, there is a God, but you have to find him yourself. And I started searching. And I wasn't sure after all that in the concentration camp. And then I in Holland I met a couple. They were Jewish, but they believed in Jesus.
In other words, they were Messianic Jews. They believed.
Yes, Messianic Jews.
All right.
And he came over. He was very nice, and he didn't pressure me at all. But I started reading the Old Testament, and actually, I found the Messiah in the Old Testament.
I was at Isaiah 53.
Isaiah 53, and Psalm 22, and some other ones. And then I went to the New Testament. So I was absolutely convinced that Jesus was Jewish Messiah. And then I had an emotional experience one night, and I surrendered completely.
What happened that night when your life changed?
That night I went to bed. It was in Mount Hermon. We went to some lectures there. And I went to bed, and all of a sudden I saw Jesus on the cross, and it occurred to me, oh my goodness sake, he is there because I have sinned, and he has taken all my sins. And my goodness sake, how didn't I see that before? And I started crying, and all of a sudden, I saw Jesus, and it was so a peaceful experience. And I went to sleep. That was it.
Well, I think I've heard this description really from Jewish people before, who've actually had a supernatural experience and met Jesus and in person. And of course, as an evangelical Christian, I've never had that experience, but I believe it's true. And I let Jesus guide my life. But this must have given you some solace, some reason for all these terrible, terrible things that, because of course God has a plan for our lives. We don't understand it. We don't understand why what things happen.
We don't understand then what's going on now. We don't understand either. But he has a plan, and it will come. He is still in charge.
And of course that is really the theme of your book, The Searching Survivor. That the theme of your book, The Searching Survivor, of course, is surviving with terrible things that had happened, looking for the reason. Uh-huh. There has to be a purpose. Well, Marian, it's a really a very touching book, because as you talk about your father, you talk about your upbringing, you know, and the home that you were raised in with a mother who seemed to be very distant, and certainly a father who was very domineering, but obviously a very, very a brave and very, very principled individual,
right.
And who really did the best that he could, and then, of course, the whole world falling apart when the Nazis come to power.
Right. Right. And there were, of course, my roots. I wrote about my roots. It was my vet nurse who stayed with me.
Right. And this was the woman who nursed you and who had actually cared for you and all through your young life. And, of course, as you described, she really did too much for you, so that when, of course, you were forced to be on your own, why, of course, it was difficult because you didn't know how to clean and how to cook and do all of these things. But you eventually learned. You saw the real world as it was, not the world you were raised in.
May I add another word?
You certainly may.
Okay, Marion, during the 1931-32, she was a young girl then, and she was in training for the 1933 Olympics. She had a very good trainer, and he kept her strongly at it, knowing very well that she could very well set a world record in the high jump. And then, so he just pressed her for that. From that time until now, well, that experience made her strong. It also kept her diet severely under control, so that when she got to the concentration camp, the depletion of food and the terrible quality of the food they got didn't bother her nearly so much as it did everybody else who was there. She was able to survive on it, not thrive, but she survived. And then, when it was all over, she continues to this day some of the exercises that she learned back then.
Well, if she certainly sounds like she's in pretty good shape considering her age and her mind is intact.
Oh, yeah, she is out walking as often as she possibly can, and I follow her in the car. Where it's warm.
Well, of course, but she actually, of course, would have been very competitive in the Olympics, and unfortunately, why, of course, because she was Jewish, they would not allow her to compete.
No, they wouldn't.
And that must have been very disappointing for her.
Also, the Germans also lost the high jump in that 1933 Olympics.
Well, because in fact, it was that 33 or 36 Olympics she was training for. Because, of course, the Olympics, right? There was one.
Yeah, the Olympics.
And, of course,
36, I guess.
36 Olympics, because that's when Jesse Owens beat the German race. I forgot what it was, the 100-yard or 220, whatever it was. But here's this black who had actually defeated the Aryan candidate from the Nazis. And Adolf Hitler was furious, you know, because they looked down upon the blacks as inferior, and his prize candidate had lost. So, certainly God doesn't respect one race over another. He's given us all special talents, and he's certainly given the blacks very often an ability to run far better than he's given us. So, I think it's important. But anyway, the Germans certainly lost out by, because of their position. But eventually, there was a terrible.
Well, she has retained her strength to this day.
Well, her legs,
which were, the concentration was there during her early years. Her legs are still the strongest part of her.
Well, of course.
I can't keep up. I am 15 years younger than she is, and I can't keep up with this woman.
Well, anyway, this is Marion's husband, and of course the thing is that Marion actually had trained for the Olympics, the 36 Olympics there in Germany, and of course might very well have gotten the gold medal in the high jump. She was excellent at it, but of course because she was Jewish, why they wouldn't let her compete. And, of course, this terrible, terrible prejudice on the part of the Nazis. But, of course, what is really so tragic is that all the good German people went along with it, and so many of the good people, even though they knew it was inherently wrong, didn't have the courage to stand up. And this is what happens in a totalitarian state. People are governed by fear instead of by what's right, and most people will go along with things that are just terribly wrong and terribly evil. And I think a lot of the people recognize that Adolf Hitler was evil, but it was easier to go along than to take a stand. Well, anyway, of course...
Talking of evil, did you read the episode with Dr. Mengele?
Yes.
How do you understand that? I never could understand. I can't understand it today.
Well, I think, Marion, if you listen to our programs, we talk about the fact that there really is evil in the world. And you use that phrase several times in your book about Adolf Hitler being evil. But the reason he was evil is he was very deeply involved with a cult organizations, and certainly this permeated every aspect of the Nazi movement, including, of course, Dr. Mengele, who used to love to, do terrible things to children. And of course, what's even more frightening, he was actually helped to escape to South America in something called the Rat Line by the MI6, British intelligence, and the OSS, the American intelligence. And I've talked to at least three people who claim that they have met him here in the United States, back the 50s and 60s. I talked to a gentleman who wrote a book on the CIA and mind control, and he'd talked to at least three people who claimed that they'd met Mengele. But, of course, what most people don't understand is there is evil in the world today, and some of it was right here in the United States during those years, and I still believe it's the dominant force here. But our job is, of course, to get stories out, and I think your story is very, very touching and really very revealing. And, of course, after going through all of this, you suddenly found God, and this has given life meaning you didn't have before. Is that right?
Right. I guess I'm very sad that my Jewish people don't accept me, and they think I'm a traitor, and they think I'm bad, and they don't want to have anything to do with me, and that is so sad.
Well, it really is, because, of course, we can respect the Jewish religion, but, of course, I believe that Christianity is the true religion. And in fact, I've even been told that in some rabbinical schools...
The trouble is that most Jews draw a hard line
right.
between Judaism and Christianity. Marion and I have both found out that there is no line.
Of course there's not.
There is no line. That is, we have inherited all of our foundation from the Jewish faith, and
because they're waiting for the Messiah to come, and we're waiting for him to come again.
Right, absolutely.
And that's what it's really all about. Well, how can people get copies of your book, Marion, because it's a very touching book. Is it available in bookstores, or how can they purchase it?
You can get it through Amazon.com.
Amazon.com.
Right.
That's probably the most inexpensive way to do it. There are several bookstores that are carrying it, but they'll, of course, add several dollars onto their purchase price so they can make a profit of it. But the best way to get it is to write to Amazon.com, and I think it's less than $15.
All right, fine. What is it?
And volume two of this autobiography is due to come out any time now. We're expecting it to be coming in the mail any time now before Christmas.
All right, fine. Well, I hope when you get it, you'll get me a copy, and maybe we could do a program on that as well, because it's a very touching book. And certainly your wife writes very, very well and very clearly. And then you almost have a feeling that you were growing up with her there in Germany and on the eastern part of Germany during the years, preceding the Second World War, and of course she was around in the aftermath of the First World War, and then of course a young woman in the Second World War. Nobody in Europe wanted a war. I mean, they'd seen the terrible results of the First World War, but there were powerful, what I believe are occult forces, that were intent upon the Second World War and prolonged that war long after any logical people would have done that to perpetuate the carnage and the horror. Well, we'll be back here in just a moment, and perhaps we can take some callers. Our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest is Marion Parkhurst. And, of course, her book is entitled Searching Survivor, and the Answers I Found. And so as you look back at what happened, you know, through your turmoil and through the terrible times, the terrible period you were in Belsen there, how long were you actually there, about a year?
Pardon?
How long were you in Bergen-Belsen prison?
Oh, about a little bit over 2 years.
Over 2 years?
Yeah.
And did a lot of the people die when they were there? Or
they died.
Now, was it malnutrition? Did they force you to work or what?
It was a combination of malnutrition and giving up.
In other words, just gave up because
of... Giving up because if you have no kindness and you are told you are a dirty Jew and you are... nothing worth and no kindness, then you just die. You can't live like this.
I talked to a woman, it was when I was going into the military and I was traveling by train. It was, so it would have been the early 1950s, probably 53, and she had been a Jewish person in the concentration camp in Germany, and her, what she told me was that how bitter she was because, of course, there was no effort to help one another. And she felt that, I mean, here are the Jewish people. They were all, you know, in this together, but there was no compassion. It was just, well, I'm going to live, and I want to live, and I don't care what happens to anybody else. Was, uh-huh. So that's sort of the attitude that you encountered?
Yes, yeah.
Were there any Christians in the concentration camp with you when you were there?
If I know Christians, the only Christians were the people I talked about, the Jewish people.
You mean the Messianic Jews?
Yeah.
All right, fine. Well,
that was the only one.
All right, fine. And were they any different? Did you notice anything different about them than the others who were there?
Yeah, but when we were on the train, our bread was stolen, and when they found out that our bread was stolen, they shared their bread with us. And I thought by myself, that is unheard of. I mean, but the bread is alive, you know?
Right. And,
I thought it must have to do with they believe in Jesus. It went through my head, you know?
Well, I think that we are judged by what we do, and of course, if we are true to our faith, why, people will see it, and hopefully they'll wonder what's different. We'll be right back.
Yeah.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest this evening is Marion Bauman Parkhurst. We're talking about her book, Searching Survivor, and the Answers I Found. And, of course, eventually... why Marion became a Messianic Jew. And, of course, because she had read the Old Testament. And if you read Isaiah 53, there can be no question in your mind that what Isaiah was talking about was the story of Jesus Christ, only it was written, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years before Christ was born in Bethlehem. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And we've got Herman calling from Carmel. Hi, Herman. Do you have a question or comment?
Yes. In the last few years, there seems to be a lot of controversy regarding the concentration camps and the numbers of Jews that were actually killed. And we know, of course, that it wasn't just the Jews. There were many others that were also sent to the camps. But could you comment on this whole issue? Because the two things that people seem to focus on is that it was not 6 million, and or that they weren't gassed to death. And I find it ludicrous because whether you kill somebody by shooting them, gassing them, or starving and or working them to death, the effect is the same. So why do you think this controversy is going on? and any other comments you might want to make.
Do you have any thoughts at all about that? Because there's some people who say, oh, well, the Holocaust didn't take place, or you know, there are all sorts of, they call them Holocaust deniers, and I certainly feel that this is really a conscious effort to confuse people. I mean, I've talked to people who were actually at Auschwitz and survived that terrible, terrible experience, and everybody with them on the train was killed, and maybe only three or four were allowed to live. And, of course, there at your concentration camp, there were only about 200 people actually survived. At least that's what your daughter said in the foreword to your book. Do you have any thoughts at all about Herman's question? I mean, apparently in Holland, there are only about 5,000 of the over 100,000 people who went to concentration camps who survived. So certainly most of the Jews in Holland were killed, weren't they?
Oh, Jews were what?
Most of the Jews in Holland were actually died in concentration camps, didn't they?
Yes.
And were they taking people to Auschwitz when you were there?
Uh-huh.
From your concentration camp?
Yes, our train was supposed to go to Auschwitz, but it never got there.
Well, I'm glad you didn't. Sydney, did you have any idea what would happen at Auschwitz if you did get there?
Sure, they would have put us in the oven.
Right. And for anybody out there who has any questions, we have a four-tape set with people who survived the Holocaust. And, of course, they will tell you what happened, that they were there, they witnessed it. And so there's really, Herman, I think there's a conscious effort to confuse this issue. And if you read this book, you'd realize what happened to the Jews of Holland. I mean, there was about, what, a little over 140,000, 107,000 went off to the concentration camps and 5,000 came back. That's not a very good survival ratio. Anything else, Herman?
Well, one thing I'd like to ask, Marion, is the question, how can a civilized society that has Christian roots, Judeo-Christian roots, allow something horrible like this to happen? Did you ever wonder that yourself when you were part of that?
The German church was all for, 99% was all for Hitler. All the churches, there were just a few exceptions.
Why do you think they were for Hitler?
Because he was a charismatic figure.
And because they got paid, the ministers got paid by the government over there. And so the vast majority of the ministers went right along with it. That's beautifully covered.
I don't know what happened, but all the Jewish people, all the churches, nobody helped the Jews. That's for sure.
But actually, some of the Christians in Holland, we've actually talked to people in Holland, some of the Christians in Holland who actually got sent to concentration camps because they helped the Jews.
We may also remember that when Hitler came into power, he did marvelous things, actually, for the German people. He put them back to work. He broke the back of the
Of the depression there.
The terrible financial situation that Germany was in at the time. And, of course, he put them to work manufacturing guns and planes and things for World War II. And that is one of the reasons why World War II became so terrible, because Hitler used those first 2 years before the war to build up German armaments. In this he succeeded. He also put more bread and other things on the German people's table to eat that they didn't necessarily have before. And so the German people fell in love with Adolf Hitler.
Yes, you can see that in the movies we've seen, you know, where Hitler is talking.
Uh-huh.
There'll be hundreds of thousands of people out there in the audience. Sort of reminds me of some of the pictures we've seen recently of one of our political candidates with hundreds of thousands of people cheering.
He also gave the Germans a Volkswagen.
I'm sorry, what, Marion?
He also gives the Germans a Volkswagen.
Right.
The little car.
Right.
The Volkswagen.
Right. Yes. In fact, when I was over there in Germany, why, that was the most popular car, the Volkswagen. Yeah. And in fact, when I was there in 1953 as a medical officer, as a American medical officer. And of course, you were very, very fortunate if you had a Volkswagen. Most Germans were really very impoverished after the war, and they paid a terrible price for the fact that they did not have the courage to stand up against Adolf Hitler. Because I saw those German cities, you know, as far as you could see, nothing but rubble. Mainz, I was in, Frankfurt, Cologne, just nothing but rubble, even by 1953. Anything else you'd like to ask, Herman?
Yeah, but they had some Marshall Plan.
Right.
The American paid.
Right.
Well, final question, and I'll take the answer off the air. Marion, are you concerned that the American people could fall for the same type of mistake that the German people did, that they could follow a leader and that the anti-Semitism and evils could be embraced here just as they were in Germany?
That could happen in every country.
I think that's a good answer, and I think it has to do with the country and their relationship with the Lord. And if they're close to the Lord, it would never happen. But I think that we've got real problems in America because our churches are not speaking out against evil. I've yet to hear any American minister talk about the programs of torture and the terrible things that we've done to those countries in the Middle East today.
Yes, they always need a scapegoat.
Right. Mostly
the Jews were the scapegoat.
They sure were.
Centuries.
And of course, and unfortunately, they still are in many respects. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 if you're out there and you have a question for Marion. But I get a great deal of information sent to me from one source or another. And I will tell you, there is growing anti-Semitism in America today. People frustrated, looking for somebody to blame for what's going on. And, of course, I believe there are people there putting out frank disinformation. But it's very, very concerning. And I think we have to learn from books like Marion's book, what's happened in the past, so we don't fall into the same trap the German people did, you know, in the 1930s, because I saw the terrible suffering of the German people that came about because the good people remained silent in the face of evil, organized evil. Well, again, our number 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. And certainly, fortunately, Marion was in training. She was in very, very good physical shape. And of course, she was able to survive when so many of the other people, big, strong men there in the concentration camps, were unable to survive. Now, the first concentration camp you went to wasn't Bergen-Belsen. What was the first concentration you went to?
Would you repeat the question, please?
Oh, she didn't start out at Bergen, didn't she? Start out at another concentration camp?
She started out in Westerbork. That is a holding camp in Holland.
Uh-huh.
And from there, the trains went.
Oh, did they have the people in the concentration camps working at all? Would they have jobs to do? Were they using them in factories? Or were they just keeping them locked up in the camps?
No, they stayed in Westerbork. They didn't walk. They just stayed there. But in the Bergen-Belsen, my husband walked as long as he could. He had to tear shoes apart. Why, I don't know.
He had to do what now?
Shoes.
Tearing shoes apart of the Jews who had been killed.
Oh, I see.
Their clothes were salvaged.
I don't know what the purpose was.
Yeah, the clothes were worth more than the people were to the Germans. So that's why Walter was tearing shoes apart.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. Well, because Walter, then, how long did Walter live after you got out of the concentration camp?
Pardon?
How long did Walter live after you got out of the concentration camp?
How long did he live?
Uh-huh.
Oh, he lived, He was about, when he died, 86.
In 1986. Now, how did you happen to come to the United States? How did you get
here? He had his family here.
And so you were able to come and come into the United States? And
He had his family here. His father was Peter Tursen.
Okay, fine. And but his father wasn't practicing here in the United States, was he?
His father? No, his parents were dead.
I see. So.
Yeah. But he had a sister who was here, and he had a brother.
And so you were able to come here, and of course you've been here then for how many years now?
We are here since 1947.
Oh, you came over right after the war then.
Yes, a long time. And I still have the accent.
No, you speak far better English than I speak German. So that's but anyway, of course, actually serving in the military for 2 years in Germany, I'm ashamed of the fact that I never did learn the language or didn't learn it fluently.
German is a very hard language.
Right. Well, anyway, of course, you know, looking back on the whole experience and really having seen what happened and then coming to a personal relationship with the Lord, certainly this at least gave some meaning or some closure to a lot of what you'd experienced, didn't it?
Yeah, I know I couldn't have survived without the Lord. I know that. That he was with me all the time.
And I really think this is why one of the messages we try to get out to our program, Marion, is that people are going to have a personal relationship with the Lord, and they're going to have to learn how to trust him, because I think we may very well be in for some terrible times here in the United States in the coming months and years. And our hope and prayer is that people will have a relationship with the Lord and be able to actually survive the difficult times that lie ahead, because if they don't have that relationship, why they're never going to be able to get through what lies ahead. Well, our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. The book is short. It's got a lot of pictures in it of her dad and of her family and the various people she talks about. And certainly growing up as a young girl there, a Jewish girl in Germany, was, I'm sure, very, very difficult. Because, of course, the terrible discrimination, and how would our listeners like to be, ostracized and criticized because of their religious beliefs, and that, yet that is exactly what happened in Europe, and it wasn't just in Germany. The Nazis, of course, went into Holland, they went into all the countries there, and, of course, in France and certainly in Eastern Europe, why, of course, there were, literally millions of Jews, and most of them, the vast majority of them, were executed and died in the concentration camps. And the fact that people deny the fact that the Jews died by the millions in the concentration camps simply reflects the propaganda that's being put out to focus our attention on the wrong issues. Well, our telephone number again, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. And certainly, as it says in the back of the book, the author's stubborn will to live spurred her on and through each of the new challenges and tragedies she faced. And in the process, she discovered the God she's been searching for the whole of her life. And I think that's what's so important about the book, is that I think most people are searching for meaning to life. And, of course, you eventually found it. When did you actually become a Messianic Jew or accept our Lord as your Savior?
Yes. I don't know. I really don't know how people can live in these days without the Lord, because we live in so terrible times.
I think you're...
How do you cope?
Oh, a lot of people don't cope. Cope with it. They just bury themselves in sports or in just all sorts of activities because they don't want to see the world as it really is. And it's much more exciting to watch a football or basketball game or certainly to watch the thrillers on television than to face the real world we live in.
Uh-huh.
But yeah. Our job is to try to force people to see the... See what's going on. In fact, I got a letter the other day from a woman who listens to our Saturday program in Southern California. She says, I listen to every Saturday, but it's all doom and gloom. And I say, well, but, you know, we have to get people to know there's a problem. I mean, if you don't want to know what's really going on in the world, why, you can always turn off the program or listen to something else. They'll give you the good, you know, this good feeling type of religion, but people have to understand the true nature of the spiritual battle, which we're engaged in, if they're going to be effective in this battle. Well, Marion, what are the thoughts you'd like to leave with our listeners tonight? What are the thoughts you'd like to leave with our listeners tonight?
What I would like to leave?
Yes, uh-huh. In other words, what ideas, what is the real message you would like to leave with our listeners?
Well, I believe that the way the world looks right now, very bad, especially in the United States. But I just want to say that the Lord is still in charge, and His time, and it's not our time. If the time will come, He will act, and it's all in the Bible. You can read it.
It really is, and of course, this is what we have to know: is that the information is there, and we have to learn how to use it. Good night. God bless, and thanks very much, Marion.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course our guest this evening has been Marion Parkhurst. Her book, Searching Survivors, a very, very touching story of the life of a young Jewish woman in, first of all, Hitler's Germany, and then, of course, as they travel up into Holland, and she tries to escape from the Nazi influence, and then, of course, the Nazis invade Holland, and then, of course, eventually they all know that they're going to be taken to concentration camps, and she and her husband are picked up and taken to a concentration camp. Were really of the tens of thousands of people there, only really 200 people were able to walk out of Belsen alive. And of course, there were a number of concentration camps, a chain of concentration camps. For those of you out there in the listening audience who certainly question at all the background of the Holocaust, we have a wonderful four tape set that contains my interviews with the people who went through this living hell, and the people who were actually at Auschwitz, and their job was to take the bodies out of the ovens. And for the people who say it didn't happen, well, of course, you'll have to argue with the people who were there. And, of course, others, stories of Jews or people, Messianic Jews who were there. And even if you were a Messianic Jew and you believed in Jesus Christ, if you were Jewish by birth, why, of course, you were going to be hauled off to the concentration camp. And terrible, terrible things happened to these people.
Yes. I want to tell you something.
Yes, go right ahead.
We were in Israel about 26 years ago. We went to a university there for 1 year. And at that time, there was no Messianic Jews there. Today, there are 26 congregations, Messianic congregations, in Israel.
I know Messianic Jews over there, and of course, they're not very welcome. In other words, there's a tremendous resistance to, or almost a, like a fear of Christianity among the Jews, and yet they're looking for the Messiah, and what a wonderful thing it is to realize that he's already been here, and he's coming again.
That are the extreme.
Right. Well, I really want to thank you so very much for taking your time to be with us this evening, and I do hope when you get your new book, you'll get me a copy of it, and we can read that, and perhaps we can do a program with you at that time, okay?
Okay.
Good night, and God bless, and thanks very much, and I want to thank your husband for being there, and Mr. Parkhurst, and for helping us as well. Good night. God bless you both.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we do hope you enjoyed our interview with Marion and her husband. And this is a very touching story, and we do have a four-tape set entitled The Holocaust. And actually, you'll hear my interviews with Holocaust survivors. And remember, Marion is in her about 96, But we have many of the people who lived through the Holocaust are dying off. And one important thing we do is to actually record the stories of people before they do pass away. Many of the people we've interviewed have passed away, but we still have their message. And, of course, that's the beauty of tapes and CDs. You can hear their voices and tell the story. So if you'd like to get our four tapes out on the Holocaust, it's available. 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Then, of course, if you'd certainly like to get the great programs we have with Pastor Billy Crone, one of them, of course, we're featuring, and we're going to be carrying several others on the Ten Commandments and the other things. But one of the ones we have right now is called The Final Countdown, and I think it's actually of all of them the best ones that I've seen. There are two sets of five DVDs. Each one looks almost an hour long. And, of course, Pastor Billy actually talks about what is going on in the world today. And, of course, the beauty of the sermons is he has a lot of video clips that he inserts there to back up what he's saying. And certainly we've actually moved a large number of the Final Countdown, Part 1 or Part 2, or you can get them both together at a decreased rate. And, of course, the people who've watched it, we certainly had no complaints at all. One or two people might disagree with Pastor Crone's view on the rapture, but that really doesn't detract from the facts, and we can argue back and forth. Pre-trib, mid-trib, post-trib rapture. Of course, as my wife says, we believe in pan-trib, lation. That's believe it's all going to pan out. And we don't spend our times arguing about doctrine because, of course, we're told the Lord is coming again and what the signs of the times will be. The Final Countdown, I recommend to you, and you can get it by calling 1-800-544-8927. Now, if you want to understand what's really going on in our country financially, well, of course, we have back in stock now The Creature from Jekyll Island. We got in, I think, five cases of them. That would be about 60 books. We sold 55 or 52 over the weekend. I mean, this book is so much in demand, we just really have a hard time keeping them in stock. So if you'd like to get a copy of The Creature from Jekyll Island, or my little pamphlet on the history of money, what you should know, or my little pamphlet on the financial meltdown. They're inexpensive. There's some compilations of our newsletters, but there's a lot of information there that you need to have and you need to read to understand what's really going on. So we actually have The Creature from Jekyll Island in stock, The Federal Reserve Conspiracy by Professor Sutton, who had, of course, written extensively on this and many other subjects. The little pamphlet, I should not say pamphlet, it's a book. It was written 100 years ago by Andrew Dickinson White about the events that took place in France 220 years ago. It's called Fiat Money Inflation in France, because they tried in France in 1789 exactly what we're trying here in the United States. And, of course, what happened in France is exactly what's going to happen here in the United States. And they ended up with a dictator. His name was Napoleon Bonaparte. And, of course, fiat money systems always end up with dictatorship. As Aristotle had said, there's absolutely nothing wrong with fiat money as long as you have perfect authority and godlike wisdom in kings. And, of course, everybody knows that our current administration has godlike wisdom, doesn't it? Or does it? Oh, you're going to see the progressive collapse of our economy. It's a tragedy, but maybe this is God's judgment brought upon a willful people who've specifically, repudiated God's laws. Under any circumstances, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. If you haven't laid in your supply of long-term storage food or gotten your Berkey water filters, or suddenly you'd like to lay in a supply of health products, give us a call and we'll send you a catalog. Until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you.